that is my hope. That out of this solemn occasion, a better world will emerge out of the blood and carnage of the past. A world found upon faith and understanding. A world dedicated to the wish for freedom, tolerance, and justice.
We bring you this special radio television broadcast in order to give you the very latest information on an amazing phenomenon. Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen, I think something is happening.
Good evening. I hope you'll excuse me if I appear a trifle excited.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I want all of you to get up out of your chairs.
Whatever appears emerges as raw experience for those who watch it.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight.
Hello, and welcome to Sordid Cinema. My name is Simon Howell. I'm joined, as always, by Ricky D.
Hello, Simon. I got a lot to say, but first, you should introduce our two special guests.
All right. Special guest the first, after a long absence, former regular co-host Mr. Edgar Chaput.
Good evening, gentlemen. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm thrilled to be back. I'm going bananas.
Ayo!
Now, Edgar, I wanted you specifically on this podcast, and I reorganized my whole entire schedule because you wrote this fantastic retrospective over a cut print film. It was massive. It was huge. How many words? Like 16,000 words about the entire Planet of the Apes series.
I remember doing that. I didn't do the word count. It was probably somewhere in the vicinity of 3,000, I suppose. I mean, there are a lot of movies in that franchise, so.
Mm.
A lot of reading, a lot of movie watching.
This might be the only rebooted franchise that ends up shorter than the original.
I guess so. Although there are, there's word on the interwebs that, despite what happens in the film we'll be reviewing tonight, the studio's thinking about a sequel.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I would be remiss if I did not also introduce our second special guest here after an even longer absence. It's Bill Messe.
Hi, guys.
Wow, it's been a
nice
long time.
To be back.
It's been so long. So, Bill used to write some of the best articles over at our old website, soundinsight.org. And in fact, Bill, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but before I left Sound Insight, which was rebranded to popoptic.com before it shut down, I did check Google Analytics, and the most popular article ever published at soundinsight.org was your article, The Gray Ones Fade to Black, which I assume had well over a million views. And I think the reason why it was so popular, and I don't know if you know this, is because Roger Ebert promoted the crap out of that article.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I know he had mentioned it. I did not realize it had detonated like that.
Oh yeah, it was our most popular article, hands down. It used to get traffic every year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember some of the HBO articles he used to write. Those were pretty fascinating as well.
Edgar, that wasn't an article.
It became a book.
A book, yeah. It became a book.
Yeah.
What is?
That's one of the reasons we invited Bill here today, because you've got a new book, if I understand that correctly.
Yes, I do. The Rules of Screenwriting and Why You Should Break Them.
It's too bad Patrick's not here.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's I'm very excited to talk about the rules as you see them and also why they're meant to be broken. I'd love to talk a little bit of film history. I'd love to talk a little bit of Planet of the Apes. We got a lot to talk about. I guess we should start for the reason that most of y'all, I assume, are here, which is to hear about, of course, War for the Planet of the Apes, the new film by Matt Reeves, and of course the third film in the rebooted Apes franchise. Let's hear a quick clip.
He's a smart one, isn't he? What are you going to name him?
Do they look like just apes to you?
He saved our lives.
He was remarkable.
You're him. You're Caesar. We've been searching for you for so long.
Tell your colonel, we are not savages.
Target is dead.
Prepare for battle. They took too much from me. Die every day.
Human gets sick, ape gets smart, then human kill ape. But not me. I rot.
There are times when it is necessary to abandon our humanity to save humanity.
All of human history has led to this moment.
And if we lose, it will be a planet of apes.
You're back on Sordid Cinema. That was a clip from War for the Planet of the Apes, the new film by Matt Reeves, the sequel to his Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. It will never not bother me that Rise comes before Dawn in this season, and I have to keep reminding myself. I feel like that's one of those rules that shouldn't be broken, but anyway, I'm gonna have to get over it. This is the third installment of the rebooted Planet of the Apes franchise, the second outing for Matt Reeves, once again starring Andy Serkis in a motion capture performance, once again as a photorealistic ape, in this case Caesar, the leader of the roving band of apes we've been following for the last two films. Here they're a little bit beleaguered as they are menaced by a human military force led by the nefarious Woody Harrelson. That's actually his character name, the nefarious Woody Harrelson. No, he's not. That's not, that was a lie that I just said. No, as the mysterious colonel.
I thought he was playing the role from Marlon Brando's character in Apocalypse Now.
Oh, yeah. That's well, we can talk about that. But yes, there are certainly some very overt nods to Vietnam films of the past, especially. Anyway, all the apes want to do is find a new home. But of course, the humans just keep getting in the way. And it doesn't go well for Caesar in particular, who faces a rather enveloping and driving tragedy pretty early in the film, which I'm sure we'll talk about soon enough. Edgar, I guess I may as well start with you because you've just chronicled the entire, how many apes movies does that make that you've seen now?
Let's see. There are five films in the original. Then you got the Tim Burton one. So that's six. And then these three new ones. So nine. Yeah. I've watched nine ape films in the past few weeks. It's quite a
bit. Wait, you didn't watch the TV series?
That would have been
an animated series too,
and the animated series.
Edgar, you're an awful completist.
Yeah,
you got to go back and do the article again, man.
You got to give him credit. He watched the Tim Burton disaster piece, which, although there's a lot to like about that movie, it is god awful. But anyhow, back to Edgar.
Yeah. So, I guess I'd love to get your overall take on the new trilogy and how you think this one fits in quality wise.
I think this is, and I allude to this briefly if you want to check out that marathon of an article I wrote. I think this new series is pretty interesting insofar as it decides to tell the story of the Rise of the Dawn and the War for the Planet of the Apes in a rather different dramatic way than in the original series. When you watch those older films, which I love to varying degrees, there's a lot of shock value, it's surprise, twists, and most of them are a lot of fun. This new reboot is very linear. it's predicated very much on story, on character, on drama. It's like it's always boiling, you know, underneath the surface, and sometimes it erupts, but it's not as shocking as the original series. But I respect that approach. You know, it takes sort of some courage and some cojones, so to speak, to say, we're going to reboot this whole thing, but we're not going to do it at all in the same way that made the original films so enjoyable and so thrilling. We're going to do it a completely different way. We're going to do it super linearly, no twists, a little plot twists here and there, but there's no, you know, none of these movies end with, you know, damn you all to hell and the Statue of Liberty under sand. You know, that doesn't happen in this series. And this third one is my favorite of the three. In fact, my gut reaction is it's actually my favorite Apes film. You know, we'll see if that holds up in the years to come when I rewatch it and so on. But it's my favorite Apes film of all the ones, actually.
Wow, that's quite a statement. Ricky, have you seen the entire original series?
No, I've watched about two or three of the original. I've seen the first film, I would say about two times, but it's been a long time since I watched it. This is way back when we worked at Movieland Video. And I'm a huge fan of the new franchise, the new series, specifically the second film. Matt Reeves is one of my favorite filmmakers, one of my favorite directors working in Hollywood. I think that what they are doing specifically with the series, like the reboot, I kind of wish Marvel was doing something similar in terms of the way they're building this world, these characters, this franchise, but they seem to be doing it in the best way possible. That said, this is my least favorite of the three films. I'm a huge fan of the second one. I really like the first one. I feel like a lot of people just did not like the first movie because they don't like James Franco, and he's not bad in the movie. I actually really, really like that movie, but the second one is like stellar. It was like, I think, one of my favorite movies that year. I think when we did our list of the best movies released, it landed on like the top five. Everyone seemed to like that movie. My problem with this movie, Simon, and I think you're going to agree with me, it's all about the screenplay. And I think that if you eliminate the little girl, the monkey from the zoo, and Woody Harrelson's character, this might be a good movie, a great movie. Sorry, I think it's just a good movie. I think, and I could not help but think this, like, this is not something I thought of like afterwards, like when I was just sitting back and trying to figure out why I didn't like this movie. Like, it's the first impression I got like right away within like, I would say like the first 30 minutes of this movie, which by the way is really long. I think it's like 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
I could not help but feel that the original vision of this movie was so bleak, so grim, so dark that they felt the need to add the comedy that comes with the monkey from the zoo. The Steve Zahn character. And then also adding the young girl. Because, okay, like, in all honesty, like, I get it. Like, this is a war movie. And I would say at one point it's also a prison break film. Like, they break out of prison, right? But what I liked about the first two movies is they didn't shy away from the brutality and the horrors of what's going on in this universe. And in this movie, like, it's intense. It is grim and depressing at times. Do not get me wrong. But I still feel like they try to lighten the mood because we do get the humor, especially from Bad Ape at times, that just felt inappropriate and ill-timed. And just like, It should not have been there. And Woody Harrelson's character, like, apart from the fact that he's channeling Marlon Brando from Apocalypse Now, I mean, that in itself is problematic because he's not even a great actor. He's like an okay, just slightly above that average actor. But his character, I mean, okay, I kind of felt like I knew exactly where the movie was headed beat by beat. Like, for example, you know right away, as soon as he picks up the doll or she picks up the doll, and when they decide to bring the girl along, which really doesn't make any sense. It's just a way to move the plot forward to get the girl to the prison so the doll can get into the hands of Woody Harrelson so he can get infected with the same disease that infected his son. And he shot his son because he just did not want his son to grow up living like quote unquote like a zombie.
Spoilers.
Like, it was so obvious, right? And yeah. So the thing is, that just really bugged me because I felt that wasn't clever at all. And I felt like those three characters can be removed from the movie and you could still have a great film that focuses on the characters we really care about, which is the apes, specifically Caesar and his family. And I feel like those characters are more human than the actual humans in the film.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the common line about these movies, right? That these photorealistic apes are so stunning to watch. And it's remarkable that in an age when, you know, there's this common complaint that digital effects are getting worse and worse, which is largely true, somehow these films, and this extends to the first film, manage to, like, they do so much with their effects, and there's no uncanny valley moment at all, which is... I think it says something about the use of apes versus you know, digitally aged humans or whatever. But anyway.
But you know why? It's because the way they shoot these films, it's no different than how they shoot some of the big AAA title video games like Last of Us or Uncharted. They use motion capture. They put these actors in a room, mostly green screen, and they wear these suits. But like the way it's not just all done on a computer. Like they actually like it's just like I don't know how to explain it, but if you ever watch like the making of, say, The Last of Us and watch the making of Planet of the Apes, you'll see it's very similar in terms of how they tackle the special effects. especially the action.
Mm-hmm. This was also my least favorite of the trilogy, and actually it was by a fair distance. As much as I do like Matt Reeves, I think both of his films are inferior to the first one. And I think that because as much as we have this common line about how, oh, the apes are more interesting than the humans, the first movie is the only one that actually gets you to care at all about the human characters. Like the Jason, I had to look up who stars in the second one, having seen it more recently than the first one. Like, oh yeah, it was Jason Clarke and Carrie Russell. Carrie Russell, who's like incredible on The Americans, got nothing to do in that movie. Jason Clarke, who is actually more believable as a monkey in a person suit than as a regular person. Just like you had absolutely no emotional connection to the humans in the second film, which is problematic because they're taking up so much of the movie. In this film, we spend less time with humans than ever before, which is not necessarily a bad thing. My problem with the third film is that, first of all, I think you're right, Ricky, to say that the tonal imbalance in this movie is weird. I'm not sure that I had quite the same problem as you did, though. I was fine with the bad ape character, if only because the movie is so bleak. This is literally like a movie where 100 minutes of the movie or more takes place in basically Ape Auschwitz, which is like, I guess, a decision you can make for your summer blockbuster. I will say this, it's an interesting film. It's like not your typical, you know, summer Hollywood action tentpole movie. It's like, it is very grim. It's got scenes of monkey torture, monkey execution, monkey work camps. Sorry, ape monkey work shit. Camps. Well, that's sort of another thing. You've got this very bleak source material. There's very bleak material that has nods at, you know, the Holocaust and Vietnam and all this stuff. And obviously, more directly, you've got these sort of cinematic references to stuff like Apocalypse Now and Paths of Glory.
But then they throw in this bad monkey character. You don't find that problematic? Like, imagine if this character showed up in the middle of Schindler's List, like a character similar to that.
It would be like, I would be pissed. See, I find it problematic that if you're trying to make a movie as serious as Schindler's List with like CGI apes, like that to me is the bigger ask. Like, okay, but we agree, but we disagree on the specifics, because I didn't have a problem with the bad ape character. To be clear, for people who haven't seen the film, which we've spoiled the hell out of it, so I hope you have. The Steve Zahn character is called Bad Ape because he was called Bad Ape so often that he thinks that's what he's called. The thing is, I actually thought Steve Zahn gives a great comic performance, and I will say that my audience really responded to it. If it weren't for that character, the movie would be so grim, so unrelentingly bleak, that it would be almost unbearable. So in that sense, I didn't have a problem with the character. What I did have a problem with were these nods to past films, like, and these things like, I don't know, when you have like Apocalypse Now scrawled on the wall of a cave. That's a thing that actually happens in the middle of this very bleak film.
The Full Metal Jacket references
the many Full Metal Jacket references.
Yeah, but they like in the back of the helmets will have like the name of whatever ape that's working with the humans. Yeah. Like Donkey, for example. It's like there's so many shots that resemble these past films. And the thing about this film is I do like this film. I'm going to say this three times. I like this film.
But like you're summoning the Candyman.
It's my least favorite of the series. And the thing is, I also felt that unlike the first two films, this film really felt like it was trying to build this universe in a sense that they're trying to set up the trilogy and connect it to the original film, because it ends where the original film, the original Planet of the Apes film, begins. And I could not help but feel all of those movie references over flooding the screen and sort of like pulling me out of the film. And I kind of like disagree with you, Simon. Like I'm not saying I need my films to be gritty and dark. Like, you know, when people say I want my Batman to be dark and gritty, but this is like, I mean, this is a film that's dealing with some serious issues, like, you know, regardless if it's apes and or not. And I just kind of felt like the humor was just, it's not that I could have used humor in this film, but it's just that it would come at the wrong moments. Mm-hmm. Like you would get these scenes where the apes are being brutally like whipped and beaten and they're starving and they're caged. And then it would just cut to this weird scene of Bad Ape just doing stupid shit just to kind of get the audience to laugh. And I'm like, there's nothing wrong with the audience feeling uncomfortable, because they should.
Well, the other problem, and I will let you cut back in the film's defense at some point, Edgar, is that, like, you know, the PG-13 rating has been pushed so far by other films where it's like you start to wonder what the point is of the distinction between PG-13 and R a lot of the time. But here you really feel it, because this is a film where, like, you know, these ape characters who are really incredibly human-like are getting slaughtered and tortured left and right. And yet there isn't a drop of blood to be seen. Everything is cut away from it. It feels more than in the other films by far. It feels disingenuous.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. That's why my first impression watching this movie is I felt that this wasn't the original vision they wanted, because even when Caesar's family is assassinated, it cuts away. When his best friend is killed, it's so quick, I didn't even notice that he was stabbed and or shot. I'm not even entirely sure what happened to him, but he dies. So it's like it's all kept off screen, and they polish over this like this dark, depressing film, and I just kind of feel like we would have had a better film had they not had to have given this movie like a PG-13 rating or whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of another issue, but I mean, I'll get back to you very shortly, Edgar. But to sum up my thesis very quickly, it felt like the movie was trying to do so much. Like you said, it was trying to connect back to the original films. It was trying to sort of provide a tidy resolution to this trilogy, while also, you know, obviously having branches to the future. It was trying to act as this war allegory for somehow both World War II and Vietnam, which is just completely bizarre. And like it was trying to do so many things that like some basic elements of the movie just didn't work. Like, I actually didn't have a problem with the little girl, because I think it worked as a way to demonstrate, you know, Caesar's humanity and mercy and all that stuff. However, there was just like basic spatial aspects of the movie that made no sense to me. Like, where were they traveling that the soldiers were able to like get past them and capture all their friends and then head back? Like, just the geography of the movie makes no sense to me. And then like at the end, they're in the desert. It was like, there were so many like basic like plot elements that were confusing and or needlessly obscure, even though the movie is constantly explaining things to you. I don't know. It's again, these are screenplay issues, but Edgar, it doesn't sound like you had any of these problems.
No, I didn't. I guess a couple of points. Cause we don't want this review to last as long as this movie. About Bad Ape.
Nothing should last as long as this movie.
Well, Michael Bay's doing a pretty good job with those Transformers movies. The Bad Ape character, much like you, Simon, I didn't have a problem with him. And I think one of the reasons why I didn't have, or I enjoyed that character was, you know, probably like a lot of other people in the audience, I didn't laugh out loud at what he was doing, but I, you know, I was chuckling. I was like, okay, this is a little bit of, yes, it's levity in the face of, you know, this very intense drama and torture and killing and pillaging and this and that. So it is levity, sort of that classic master stroke of letting the audience breathe a little bit and chuckle a little bit once they've seen some horrifying things. That's sort of the obvious response. I think the second, maybe even the more interesting response, is his inclusion in this adventure or misadventure, I guess what you want to call it, is he's already, it's very briefly, very, very subtly alluded to the fact that he's already witnessed some pretty bad things. You know, they ask him, oh, are there, when they find him, you know, oh, are there more like you? Where are the other ones? You know, and oh, all dead, long time ago. He also mentions he had a child and he's lost his child. So what I liked about the character, in addition to just providing a bit of levity, was that different perspective, because he's had such a different background than these other apes. He's also been living on his own for, we don't really know how long, but, you know, several months, maybe a few years, what have you. So he comes at this story with a different perspective. His background and, you know, what his relationship with humans was very different from what some of these other apes have been living through over the past few years once they've started building their community. So I felt that, yes, it was levity, but it was also an ape, a chimp, with a different person. He was sort of looking at the same things through different goggles, so to speak. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And I guess my second point, which I thought you guys, Ricky and Simon, had a really interesting back and forth about, you know, the PG-13 rating and how far it's pushing it and cutting away. And I think your points are very valid. I don't want to like strike them down or anything, but I think my personal counter argument would be, I actually think it did a really nice job at, how should I say this? There are movies where you can show the blood, you can show the gore, and, you know, it'll get the R rating, it'll get the whatever 16 and over rating, whatever it is here in Canada. And then there are movies where I feel it's okay to cut away because you can leave something to the imagination. The audience will get it. Yes, the shot of Caesar's wife and his, so he has two sons, but the older son is unfortunately perishes pretty early.
He's expendable.
Yes, the shot, right? Well, we don't even see him very much in Dawn, but it's not really a character we got to know. Norton Wolf, frankly, nor is his wife. The shot.
So, I'm sorry. I kept thinking about, did they have a wedding? Like, did they rent a chapel? was anyone else thinking that, like, out loud to themselves several times?
Okay,
when that was announced?
I know what Edgar is trying to say here, but the thing is, Edgar, I'm not saying that I needed to see a shot of their brain splattered across the wall, but this is like a moment that changes his life. Like, it's when he starts to feel the rage and hatred towards humans that he
it's demonstrated in his rage. It's demonstrated, right, right. And that's what drives him for the rest of the movie.
But all we get really is a quick glimpse of them lying on the floor. And I'm nitpicking, but I kind of felt like that was a crucial moment for the entire series, not just for the character of Caesar, that I kind of felt by like not showing them getting assassinated on screen. And again, I don't need to be bloody or gruesome, but actually showing them getting shot was weird. And like you talked about how you don't know the wife, her name, her character, or the son. I'm completely confused about his sons. Like, But he has two sons, so was this son in the previous movie, or is this son new? I'm confused. And this is like, no, like seriously, this is where I'm all confused. So I'm like, who's this second kid? Where did his son and Rocket go to? Where did they come from? It was obvious that Winter was going to betray them. Like, again, knowing beat by beat where the movie is going. Like, again, I find the screenplay just lazy, despite the fact that I think the movie is good. Also, like, you talk about geography. They're in the jungle, and 2 seconds later, they're, like, on the top of Mount Everest or something. Like, I'm like, where are we all of a sudden? Are we in Canada? Like, why were you just in the jungle?
Well, hold on. The first two films take place in and around San Francisco. That's Northern California. It's not that far from the rock. It's not next door. A lot of the action, well, I shouldn't say action, but the times when characters travel from one area to another, you know, it's shown in montage, not montage, but if it's not a montage, it's sort of little mini adventures that happen, and we sort of see the climate changing. Had they been strolling for 5 days? Have they been strolling for 2 weeks? You know, that's one of those things. Like that to me is a nitpick. Like if it bothered you, okay. But that's, to me, that's a nitpick. That's like,
it's not that it did. The reason why all of this bugs me is because I left the movie feeling somewhat confused. Like, for example, who are the humans who are attacking the humans, and exactly why are they attacking these humans? Why is Woody Harrelson held up in this base and getting the apes to build a wall, which is not going to be complete in time because they're already going to invade their camp before the wall is even complete? And if he needs the apes so badly, why does he actually use the apes to join forces to fight these humans who are going to completely demolish them? Like, all of these things were just did not make any sense. And going back to the little girl, and by the way, listeners, the reason why I'm being negative is because I know Edgar is extremely positive, so I'm trying to balance things out here. But just going back to the little girl, and I swear to God, this is the last negative thing I'm going to say. Her character wasn't a character. She was like a prop. She was just used to, like, move the plot forward, to take this one specific disease, move it to the base, and just infect Woody Harrelson's character. She wasn't a character. Like, she was, like, useless.
I think she also meant to... I won't entirely disagree with you on there, but I will add this point. I felt she... What I'm about to say doesn't make her a character in defense of your point, but I think what the purpose she also served was, she sort of represented that one of the last few remaining threads of compassion between humans and the apes. Because let's be honest, most of the humans in this movie want to kill the apes, and some of the apes feel vice versa about the humans, frankly. And so you have this character who is, you know, in an allusion to the first film, she's baptized as Nova. But she's sort of still the remaining a vestige of compassion from the humans. It doesn't make her a character, but at least there's something symbolic about her presence.
Okay, well, that's a fair point. You've done a good job in defending the movie. Let's talk about Nova and bring Bill in, because so is Nova the character from the original film? Am I remembering this correctly?
Well, there is a character in the first two movies, Nova. But considering that those movies take place several centuries after these movies, I don't think it's a literal connection. These two sets of movies really live in two different universes. They may try to connect them, but they really don't. They're both very much products of their times, their respective times. And I'd even break it down into three groups. You have this trilogy. You have the first original film, and then you have the four sequels. The four original sequels, they're mercenary efforts. You know, the thing that I give this trilogy credit for is there's an architecture holding all three of them together. I don't know if that's how they started out, but definitely as they decided to go forward with the reboot, there's a design to this. There really was no design to the original series. They made a ton of money with the first movie. It was old studio sequeling. Let's jump on this. And then if you look at how fast the four sequels come out, once they start, they come out every year. The original Planet of the Apes comes out in 68. Beneath the Planet of the Apes comes out in 1970. And it's a huge moneymaker. It's the 83rd top grossing movie of the decade. And it's not because it's that good a movie. A lot of that was the curiosity element. How do you follow up the original? And then after that, Escape from the Planet of the Apes comes out in 71. Conquest of the Planet of the Apes in 72. Battle for the Planet of the Apes in 73. Each one made for less money than the one before. There is no real design to them. And if you look at them sequentially and you try to tie them to the first movie, they don't even always make a whole hell of a lot of sense. So the Nova in these, if they are planning on going ahead, and it's hard for me to imagine a studio making the kind of money off this series, and with this last movie being as successful as apparently it's going to be, not going ahead and trying to keep pumping juice into this. But these days, series do seem to have this connecting architecture. The original, as I said, that was old style sequeling. Let's just milk this while it's hot.
Yeah. You've sort of inadvertently pointed out one of my major problems with this film specifically. The first of the reboot films, Rise, I think did a great job of sort of evoking the spirit of the originals. I mean, I've only seen the first of the originals, so obviously I'm stretching that a little bit, while bringing it to a modern context and giving it a contemporary flavor by sort of, you know, it was evoking these fears of contagion and pandemic, having this very contemporary feeling showdown with armed police officers on the San Francisco Gate Bridge, on the Golden Gate Bridge rather. It felt like a movie of its time, and it's odd to me that this movie is constantly riffing on wars of 30 and 70 years ago. Like, why does it feel the need to like hearken back to you know, 20th century history? Like, why it doesn't feel like it connects meaningfully in that way to the earlier films in the trilogy. Like, again, it feels like it's trying to do too much by evoking like the whole sort of scope of human warfare.
Well, very interesting point there you made there, Simon. Really interesting. I would say that
it's very
natural, Edgar. Yeah, thank you very much. I'm a natural podcaster. I think your point is rather astute about this most recent film, War, sort of alluding to Vietnam and World War II, and that maybe feeling a little bit strange. I guess my one sentence response would be, history repeats itself. Is that not one of the overriding themes of the friend, be it the original or be it this one? Us humans, we humans, you know, we just can't seem to get our crap together, and we keep making the same mistakes again and again and again. I still see some value in your point, but I didn't have an issue. I mean, a war camp is a war camp. I mean, maybe
do we
make the same mistakes though?
Do we make the same mistakes? Like, exactly. I always find that to be kind of a lazy point that filmmakers make. Oh, history repeats itself, and we do the same things again. Do we really, though? I feel like that's a lazy theory of history. Sorry, that's an argument.
We don't.
Yeah.
And I think I'm trying to get my thoughts straight on this, because it's a little bit complicated. I'm going back to something I said earlier, that each of the series, well, let's forget about the original sequels, because as I said, that was about making a dollar. They spent less on each one. I mean, the budgets by the end got pretty skimpy, and you can make an easy argument that along with skimping on the budgets, the movies got a bit dumber. Whereas in the new series, whether you like them or not, you have to give them credit that they are obviously committing a lot of resources to trying to make each one, to build the trilogy to a legitimately fulfilling climax. But in terms of being a product of their time, and I'm going to say this knowing, A, that I have a natural bias. I'm older. I grew up with the original films, and it's hard for me to I realize it's sometimes hard for me to step back and remove the nostalgia and try and make a cool appraisal here. But one of the points I tried to make in a book I wrote several years ago, this is where I get my plug in, called Overkill, which was looking at the evolution of the movie thriller. So about the last 20, 30 years, the big budget thriller, the financial heart of the movie business, there's a skewing towards a young audience, younger than it used to be. It's been young since the 50s. This is younger. And there's been an emphasis on action, effects, scale, and more than anything else, elements of fantasy. I mean, I find it very interesting that in this, the new series, this trilogy, the main characters are the apes. The sympathetic characters are the apes. And that plugs very much into a modern-day movie-going sensibility of trying to get yourself out of who you are. To identify with the apes and make your fellow human beings the enemy. You wake up in the morning, you see the news, not a lot to like about humankind. We're going to give you somebody you can identify with, and it won't be the humans. It'll be the apes. It'll be the avatars. It'll be somebody that you can plug into in a kind of semi-escapist way, that as grim as the movies are, they're still somewhat removed from the rather grim world you live in. Mm-hmm. The original Planet of the Apes was for a somewhat older audience, and it was a direct confrontation with the angst of the day. There's a lot less action in it than there were even in the sequels. Once you get past the original hunt, there's not a lot of physical action in the movie. It was dealing with a sense of imminent destruction that if you look at the movies of the 60s, Planet of the Apes comes out in 68, there was this prevailing sentiment, not just a fear of nuclear war, but there were a lot of movies that made the case it was inevitable, that sooner or later it was going to happen. Failsafe, Dr. Strangelove, Bedford Incident. We had been through the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis. And if you take a careful look at that movie, it's been interesting to hear some of you talk about how grim this third movie is and whether or not the comic relief is a good or bad thing. The original movie is rather grim. In 68, when we went to see this, and keep in mind that there hadn't been anything like this before, that this was a real groundbreaker of a movie in its time, you kept waiting for some sort of release, that somehow this was going to come out on a high note, and it doesn't. At the end of this movie, going to your point about do we repeat ourselves, the main character played by Charlton Heston, Taylor, who's, as opposed to most movie heroes of the time, and even of today, is really an abrasive ass. He's arrogant, he's condescending, he's abrasive. And the reason that he has gone on what is a one-way mission was because his line is, I can't help but believe there's something in the universe better than man. Has to be. And when he lands on this planet, and we later find out that it is Earth and that man has been supplanted by the apes, that ape civilization encapsulates everything that was bad about people.
Wait, what? Right? It was Earth the whole time?
Biases in time. The original Planet of the Apes? Yes.
Yeah, sorry. That was attempted a joke.
And he's teasing.
And what's also curious is I've shown this movie in film study classes now. And when I show it to them, again, to show you how times have changed, and I ask them, so what do you think happened to the Earth? And you'll get things like disease, asteroid, you know, extermination event. You will never, you never get nuclear war. When we saw it in those days, even though they never say it, we all knew what had happened. It didn't have to get explained to us.
But you see,
and that's what I mean by product of its time.
But Bill, so when you are talking, you just make me feel like I'm completely right with my quote unquote. No, like, listen, with my quote unquote nitpicking or complaints about the new film. Like that's the thing. Like, I feel like that's the difference between the original film when it first came out in 68 and why it's so special and a classic as opposed to this film. Like, I feel like this film is still this Hollywood studio making a big blockbuster. They want to make as much money as possible. And so they feel the need to throw in this girl who walks around the entire film with a big, huge smile on her face, despite the fact that this is supposed to be a bleak, grim film with apes being tortured and murdered left and right, and it's the end of the world and the end of humanity. But it just seems like it's acceptable to throw in this character, much like Bad Ape. And I don't have as much of a problem with Bad Ape, but to me, that's kind of like it's the studio trying to lighten the mood to pander to an audience because they don't think the audience will be able to handle a grim, dark movie or like it. And movies made in the 60s and 70s, especially some of the greatest films ever made, my favorite films ever made, be it Night of the Living Dead by George A. Romero, rest in peace, or any of the Dario Argento movies, any of those horror films, any of these quote-unquote classics, some of the greatest films ever made, they never felt the need to bend for an audience. I feel like this movie does, as opposed to the last two.
Well, it was a much different time. I mean, in so many ways, socially, culturally, and certainly for the industry. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, you were dealing with a motion picture industry that was on the ropes. They were in financial trouble. Almost all of the major studios were in trouble. But on the plus side, all the old managements had either retired or were dying off, and there was this new young breed of production executives that were coming in, people like John Calley at Warner's, Robert Evans at Paramount. And these are people who really, really loved movies. Now, keep in mind that in those days, the studios were not part of these big, huge entertainment conglomerates. And there were no huge aftermarkets like home video and Netflix and all of these other ways of supporting your income. A movie pretty much lived or died by what it did in theaters. And you also had this young, cinema-literate audience at the time. Cinema literacy, it was cool. People, young people, and we're talking, say, college age in their late 20s. They were very plugged in to the movie experience. And they were looking for stuff that was new. They had grown up watching the oldies on TV, which doesn't happen so much anymore. So they were familiar with what the, for lack of a better word, the dramatic baselines were. We know what's been done. We know what the traditions are. Show us how you're going to invert them. Show us how you're going to twist them. You're going to bend them. You're going to energize them. When Planet of the Apes came out, science fiction, starting in the 50s, had been pretty much tagged as a juvenile genre. Planet of the Apes is one of the first sci-fi movies of the era to break out of that. This was not a movie for kids. This was a movie for grown-ups dealing with grown-up fears. We are afraid of imminent self-destruction. We are afraid that people are stupid enough, self-centered enough, and insane enough to destroy themselves. It was a palpable fear in the time. And if you look at the people who were involved in the making of this, on the writing end, one of the co-writers was Rod Serling.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knows him from The Twilight Zone. This was a guy who very often wrote with a social consciousness. Franklin J. Schaffner, who was the director, this is not a sci-fi or fantasy director. He comes out of live TV drama where he had done some impressive stuff. He did a live version of A Night to Remember, the Titanic sinking story. He had directed theater. If you look at the movies that he had done before Planet of the Apes, again, adult, mature movies like The Best Man, which was a political drama, The Warlord, very adult period piece, and then he comes to Planet of the Apes. This was not the kind of studio product that you were referring to. This was a serious filmmaker going, I want to do something serious that's about our time. And I think that's what distinguishes the original, not only from its sequels, which were simply capitalizing on a brand name to make a couple of bucks, but also I think breaks them out from the new trilogy. And I'm not saying that it's not a slam at the new trilogy, but it's a movie designed for today's audiences, which by and large, while they are aware of the issues that are going on, are not quite as plugged into them or as connected with them or as psychologically activated by them as that audience was back then.
I mean,
which is why I can show them Planet of the Apes now and nobody in my classes will ever get what happened.
That's fascinating. I mean, I agree with a lot of that reading. I resist certainly trying to compare these new films to the originals, because as you say, they are being made in a very different mode of production and being released to a very different audience. But I would say that the reason that I favor the first film of the new series against this newer one, and full credit to Rupert Wyatt, who I think nailed that first movie, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, rather. See, it messes you up, the order of things. did, I think, a great job balancing that sort of speculative sci-fi tone of tapping into the fears of the era, along with being, frankly, an entertainment. Like, it provided you with a host of characters you actually kind of cared about, maybe not Frida Pinto so much, but through John Lithgow and James Franco, you actually had some humans you kind of cared about. There was some humor, there was some lightness, there was some humanity, and there was also the darker side, and there was plenty of blockbuster thrills to go with it. Here, you have this bizarre mix of, like, almost prestige film levels of grimness, and I almost respect Matt Reeves for delivering a movie whose themes and imagery are this dark in the middle of summer when everyone just wants light, escapist entertainment. As much as we've talked about these films as being sort of modern blockbusters, this movie does not feel like a standard issue summer blockbuster. I think we can sort of all agree on that. Like, whatever divergences it has from the grimness, like, this does
I don't agree with that at all.
You don't think so? I don't. I mean,
how quickly do we forget movies like Logan, which just came out, and there's tons of more movies that have been dark, gritty, depressing, and have been like huge tentpole movies, like blockbuster films. I think the market is changing.
I mean, they're out there. They're certainly out there. I've been teaching now for about 7 years. And in the classes that I've taught that have dealt with writing or with screenwriting or with film. And again, this goes to the time. And I'm trying not to say that I think the original Planet of the Apes is better than any of these. I'm just saying it's different. And it's different because of its time. Now we get down to old fart language. When I grew up, you know,
the first step is admitting it.
Battle lines have been drawn.
Wagons head out west towards Hawaii. But we grew up, the oldies were filler on all the local TV stations. So by the time we got to college, those of us who decided to study film, we had seen all the classics. We didn't know they were classics. We didn't know why we liked them. But when you went into those film classes, there was a fairly common set of references. We knew who all the players were. We knew what all the movies were. You film class kind of told you what it was you had been responding to them to.
Right.
If you're growing up today, unless you actively go hunting for them, the only place you can accidentally come across them is Turner Classics, at least down here in the States. You can't look for something that you don't know exists. So most of the students I get, you can talk about this massive library that Netflix has. But it's like going to a library to look for a book. You look for the book whose title you know. All of those other books mean nothing to you. So
yeah.
I'm regularly dealing with students whose frame of reference, usually it doesn't go back any further than, say, Titanic or Independence Day. Occasionally, I get a student who knows of The Godfather or Apocalypse Now. They've heard of them.
They're breaking our hearts, them, man.
But they've heard of them. They've heard of Jaws. And just trying to find a common language to talk to them gets to be tough because you wind up resorting to Spider-Man, trying to find a movie that enough of them have seen that you can have a conversation.
Whereas, okay, but
back when I was going to film classes, we all knew who Humphrey Bogart was. We all know who John Wayne was. We'd all seen Citizen Kane. We'd all seen The Maltese Falcon. Not because we were looking for good movies. We were trying to kill a Saturday afternoon.
But how old are your students?
Those were there. Excuse me?
How old are your students?
College age.
Oh, my God. I thought you were teaching, like, 15-year-olds or something.
From the sound of it.
Okay, that's it. Well, you know, but here's the thing, though, okay? We got to move on, but just to play devil's advocate, there is a lot of movies that get released per year, not to mention the TV shows. I mean, back in, like, the 80s, the 90s, you would get maybe, like, 80 movies released in a city. Now you get, in Montreal, we get anywhere between 800 and 1,000 theatrically released per year. It's insane. Nobody can keep up. Not to mention TV shows, Netflix, HBO, AMC, et cetera, et cetera. So there's so much for kids these days to keep up with in the now. Forget about revisiting classics. And that's a problem even for me these days, because I'm like doing this podcast and I would love to review, I don't know, like, say, George Romero films, which we've done in the past, but, you know, because he just passed away. But we have this movie to talk about. You know, like, there's so much going on, you can never catch up. But the thing is,
that's true, but they're going to what they're familiar with.
Right.
Mm.
Year by year, anywhere from 25 to 30% of the entire box office for the year for Hollywood is going to be earned by the top 20, 25 films. And you're damned if you find more than a couple of those that are non-fantasy, non-sci-fi, non-horror. There will be a couple up there. But for the most part, what's driving that financial engine, what is drawing the largest number of ticket buyers and repeat buyers will be movies like this, movies like the Planet of the Apes movie. Doesn't make the movies bad, and some of those movies are spectacular. I mean, I am a big, huge Chris Nolan fan because I think he's one of those filmmakers that has been able to walk a line between satisfying that audience and still doing films that are distinctive, that really have a lot going on between the ears as much as in the gut and in the heart. And there's not always a lot of that. You have an industry that is pretty much, and I'm speaking in a really broad generalization, I get that, but that is pretty much driven by more or less escapist, action-driven entertainment. And the difference between that and the 60s and 70s, and it's not a matter of that they made movies better, the circumstances then were more conducive to filmmakers going, I want to make a movie about something. And the studio would say, is it going to cost a lot of money? No, then go ahead. Because they were in such a financial corner, they were risk positive. We have nothing to lose. We're already in the shitter. Now, these entertainment conglomerates are playing a more defensive game. We have a lot to lose.
I want to ask you guys a question. Do you know what the number one grossing film, the top grossing film of 1968 was?
Of 68?
Yeah. Behind the Green Door.
No.
Space Odyssey?
Yes.
Although
yes.
It should have been.
I mean, that is mind-boggling. Like, I mean, do you think a movie that opens up with a 20-minute sequence like 2001 A Space Odyssey would make money today? Like,
you
of that
scale? You
couldn't
get it made today. And if you look at the big earners then, I mean, what was it, 2 years ago? What was the movie about the priest pedophile scandal up in Boston? I'm blacking out.
Spotlight.
Okay. Now, in the 70s, you have a counterpart, All the President's Men.
Mm-hmm.
More or less the same kind of movie, an investigative journalism movie. a movie about nothing more than a couple of people asking other people questions, a dialogue-driven movie where you kind of put, you really wind up putting the plot together in your head as they uncovered things. Now, Spotlight was an indie film, did really well for an indie film. I think it did around $80 million domestic. Okay, no big stars. I mean, no marquee value stars. All the President's Men was one of the top earning movies of the 70s, of the decade. Two major stars, major studio release. You couldn't do that today, because who the hell would go?
I mean, can I counterpoint this real quickly by just saying, like, as much as we might like romanticize the past and say, hey, it's great that these serious movies got to make a lot of money. First of all, I'm going to beg to differ on Chris Nolan, but I'm going to leave that for another time.
Also, I just got to mention quickly Get Out, which, you know, you want to talk about movies inspired by George A. Romero, horror films, you know, Night of the Living Dead was one of the top grossing films in 1968. Now in 2017, Get Out, an independent horror film, is like one of the top grossing films of the year.
Hold on. But the point that I wanted to make was that in the time that you're speaking of, no, that was a time when pretty much only white men got to make movies. And, sure. You know, there you had a whole lot more cultural homogeny ruling things. So, like, as much as we may romanticize that time, there are certainly upsides to, you know, the content deluge and, like, lack of cultural homogeny that we currently enjoy.
True. But and I'm not saying that even back then Hollywood didn't turn out a phenomenal amount of crap, because it has always turned out more crap
absolutely
than anything good. I mean, that's axiomatic. That's a law of the universe. There will always be more crap than not. And I'm not trying to romanticize the period, because the period, having lived through it, was not a great time. And paradoxically, that's what produced a lot of those movies. You had a great deal of social tumult. Life magazine called the late 60s the most serious period of social upheaval in the United States since the Civil War. It was not necessarily a happy time. And the movies could not universally be happy, because there was no way to sit in a movie theater week after week watching happy movies and going without going, you got to be freaking kidding me. Because then you'd go out and you had riots in the cities, you had Vietnam, you had Watergate. I mean, the amount of social ills that were going on were phenomenal. And out of that, and it's really a perfect storm of circumstance, and it's really no more than that, it was circumstance. Desperate studios willing to take risks on new kinds of material and new talent that happened to be coming into the business, and saying, okay, if it's not going to cost that much money, and movie making was a lot cheaper then, we're willing to roll the dice on stuff. So a lot of, let's not even say good, a lot of interesting stuff gets made that couldn't get made 10 years before, and they can't get made 10 years after that period, simply because the planets have lined up. It's not that it was a better time or that people were better people. It was just that there was a certain arrangement of business and social circumstances that allowed guys this brief window of about, I don't know, 10, 15 years to make some really impressive stuff, some of which did really well. And some of the movies that we now look back on from that period as being classics actually didn't do that well, or maybe did only moderately well. They're remembered much better than they performed at the time. And my only point isn't that these movies are bad. And there's hardly been a Guy and Kate movie that I haven't seen, many of which I have enjoyed. But there is a certain, at the top end, at the big budget end, there's a monotony we didn't used to have that gets to me after a while.
But even the
good ones have this familiarity to them that starts to drag at me.
I'm old. I feel a burning need to wrap up our Apes thoughts before we give you a chance to talk about your new book. So the last thing that I'll say is that in response to your thought about Logan and sort of the newfangled R-rated blockbuster, I still think there's a difference between a movie with outrageous comic book violence where people are getting, you know, their throats ripped out via Wolverine's claws and it's awesome, dude, versus a movie that like uses like Auschwitz imagery and calls back to and like, and you know, basically is a movie length Full Metal Jacket reference. Like that to me is a different kind of adultness that I don't expect out of like a so-called summer blockbuster. I hope that distinction makes some sense. I do appreciate the movie on that level, but as an entertainment and as a movie that is supposed to hang together on its own, it didn't engage me on the level that the first two films did, even though there are individual moments, and I can't believe I didn't mention this earlier, where the effects are so good that you actually have moments that are tremendously moving, like individual moments, like when Maurice first meets the young girl. I actually think that's an incredible sequence. But as a movie, it didn't hold together for me all that well. However, we wanted to give you, Bill, a chance to talk about your new book. And specifically, I wanted to ask you about your screenwriting roles. And maybe since we're on the general subject of Apes movies, do you feel like there's any specific rules you discussed that maybe reflect on the original Ape series?
The rules in the book, they're not really my rules. They're the
plagiarist
rules that seem to have become adopted
right
by the business. And a lot of this, I don't want to blame the guy because he gets a lot of crap thrown at him as it is. But a lot of this goes back to when Bob McKee started his story seminars. And it's not only that a lot of aspiring screenwriters bought into that, but a lot of people in the business, it seeped actually into the decision-making process as well. And it's rules like show, don't tell. Every scene has to move the plot forward, those kind of things. And the thing about them is they're nice. They're good tactics. They're good rules of thumb. They are not laws. And as I go through the book, what the book is a combination of essays about these so-called rules, paralleled with my experiences as a screenwriter, so that you get to see, well, what actually happens in the process. That all of this stuff is all well and good, but what happens when you actually have to work with these nuts, trying to get a script in some kind of cohesive shape? And then I also interviewed a number of people who were in the business that I'd had enough good fortune to work with, like Josh Sapan, who's the CEO of AMC Networks down here, Adriana Trajani, who's a writer-director. You know, what are their take on what they see happening in the business? What do they look for in a good script? And what you find out is the general consensus from people who have a good heart about this business. If I had to sum it up in one line, it actually goes to somebody I know who's a novelist. And she said, you can do anything as long as you do it beautifully. The rules are your fallbacks. Those are your basic craft guidelines, but they don't take into account inspiration, and they also don't take into account talent. One of the reasons I wrote the book was kind of a reaction against a lot of other screenwriting books where they almost make it sound like, well, if you do this and this and this, you will have a screenplay as good as The Godfather. Well, no, you won't,
right?
Because you're not Francis Coppola. You can follow the model of that movie and still wind up with a 2.5-hour turd because you're not him. You don't bring to the party what he does. That you can't teach. You can teach elements of craft, and you can show people how to cheat the craft. And one of my two favorite examples, one is the movie It's a Wonderful Life. Something like 70 to 80% of that movie is the first act. because then you have this quick second act where George Bailey sees what the town would be like without him. And then you have this really short third act where he embraces the life he's had. That those last few minutes, and you got to be some kind of real hard-hearted SOB not to get at least a little misty in those, doesn't work unless you have that painstaking brick-by-brick build of this miserable, miserable, thankless life. Now, you cannot go into a development guy these days and say, I got a two-hour movie with a 90-minute first act. You can't. The other one I like to point to is the movie version of 12 Angry Men. Anytime I ever hear somebody say, show, don't tell, I say, oh, yeah, what about 12 Angry Men? It's not only a movie where people do nothing but tell, but it's a movie about telling because we really don't know what the truth is. We're listening to people argue about what they have been told for 90 minutes. It's a hell of a movie. It's still a hell of a movie. It proves that show don't tell is a good, more often than not, kind of guideline, but it's not axiomatic. If you have a story that demands you break the rules, you don't try to gut the story to fit the rules. You bend the rules to serve the story.
So what was the last time you went to the movies to see something new and you thought, wow, that did something that, as someone with who's spoken to a lot of people about the art of screenwriting, this movie really did something form-busting or that I really wasn't expecting?
Well, that actually wasn't in the – I didn't get to see it in the movies. I got to see it on cable. And even though I wasn't overwhelmed by the movie, I was really impressed with the ambition of the architecture of the movie, and that was Interstellar. I thought he was trying to juggle too many balls, and I don't think all of the arcs quite come off. But what he was trying to do really impressed me. Christopher Nolan is really big on multiple plot arcs that operate both independently and yet have some sort of connection at some point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's a very geometric filmmaker is how I would put it.
Yeah. I mean, and he plays with timelines constantly. I mean, you see it in the Prestige. I mean, if you think about it, his Batmans are probably the most conventional things he's done. But he does like to play, and even when it doesn't work, I appreciate the fact that he's trying to do something that you're told you can't do. And that's always impressive to watch. Now, when you skate out there on the edge, the same woman who said you can do anything as long as you do it beautifully also said, but you really run a risk of getting into a hole when you get out there. Mm-hmm. And that's true. And when you're doing a movie where you got $150, $200 million on the line, it's understandable that people will tell you, yeah, you're really talented and we like what you're trying to do, but it's not your money. You can go, well, these people are only in business to make money. Well, that they always were only in business to make money.
They're just better
back
at it
when
now.
A movie. Right, but back when a movie only cost the equivalent of today, what would be like $20 to $30 million, they cut you a lot more slack.
Mm-hmm. I guess my last question before we maybe think about wrapping up is because I don't go to see blockbusters a lot, except for when I have to for this podcast. But every time I see, for instance, a Marvel movie. I do always get that feeling of this movie was made by committee, where, you know, it feels like it's following an algorithm and it needs to have certain things. It needs to have not too much of certain things in order to work. So I'm just curious, in your discussions with studio people, et cetera, did you get a feel for like how the sort of process that a major tentpole movie goes through from conception to production in order to sort of pass muster as a thing that, yes, you can get $200 million for this?
Well, I never worked at that level, which is why I'm talking to you from my basement. but even at the level where I worked, the guy who always had a voice was the marketing guy. I remember, and I tell this story. I tell the story in my book. By the way, it's Rules of Screenwriting and Why You Should Break Them if you missed it the first time. but I tell the story about working on a small-budget thriller. This was back in the 90s. And we'd gone through a couple of drafts on the script, and I thought we had a really nice, tight little script. I mean, it wasn't a great thing. It was a nice little B-movie, kind of what 30 years before would have been one of those cool little RKO thrillers. And then I get a call from the development guy, whom I had been getting along with really, really well, and he said, can you get the girl in bed with the hero? And I said, well, no, he's a guy on the run. He's letting the bad guys chase him to lead them away from his family. If he cheats on his wife, it kind of taints him a little bit. And he says, yeah, you're right. Can you get her in bed with the sheriff? I said, well, no, because there's this kind of, there's this will they or won't they tension through the movie. And if they wind up in bed, we lose that. He says, yeah, right. Can you get her naked somehow, like coming out of the shower or something? Mm. And I thought, you know, Abraham, you and I have been working together for about 8 months, and we've really been in sync. This doesn't sound like you. What's going on? And he said, well, it's the marketing guy. He says, if you can get her naked, it adds 15% to our overseas sales. And he could tell that I was sitting on the other end of the phone, kind of unhappy. And he says, just put it in. If we get any kind of a name, she'll refuse to do it anyway. So let me get this straight. You want me to write a piece of gratuitous nudity, knowing that if we get anybody any good, I have to take it out anyway so I can make the marketing guy happy. Because if the marketing guy vetoes the movie, we're dead. If he says it's a hard sell, we're dead. And especially at the level that we were working on. So it doesn't really matter what level you're at. It really matters the outfit that you're working for. If you're doing a movie like Spotlight or you're doing a movie like The Big Short and you're working out there on the indie circuit, these guys are putting money behind you knowing what it is that they're getting into. And they're also not risking $150 million. Mm-hmm. But the more money that is on the table, unless you're somebody who has a track record like Chris Nolan, where they will grant you an amazing amount of license for a big budget film, unless you're that guy, there are going to be, they don't even have to tell you what not to do. You know what you can't do. You know, for instance, on Planet of the Apes, you don't want an R rating. It may even be in your contract that you cannot deliver an R rated film. So those inhibitors are there, and they get stronger the more money is at risk. Mm-hmm. And then a different set of rules. These rules about how to write a good script, all of that goes out the window when you start getting involved in that process. Because so, then it's about how do we protect our investment.
Absolutely. So where can our humble listeners find your book?
You can go on Amazon. It is available there. And it's published. I mean, you can go to the publisher, which is McFarland. But the easiest place to find it would be on Amazon.
Fantastic. I want to thank you, Bill Messe, for coming on. Edgar, thank you for viciously defending your beloved ape movie.
Yeah, no, I get really violent when I defend movies I like.
Well, it has to happen sometimes. Ricky, thanks for joining me as always. Do visit sordidcinema.com. We got all kinds of stuff going up right now. Fantasia is happening in Montreal right now, so we've got all kinds of Fantasia coverage going up. If you care about genre film, so much Fantasia coverage is happening. So many new and interesting and exciting, and probably some not so good, but that's how festivals happen. Movies coming at you in the immediate future. Thank y'all for joining me. If there is nothing else, I believe we should wrap up. Have a good night, and we'll talk to you next week.
I see, girl. I think you human. Oh, but you ape like me. No, no. Well, put down.
How long have you been here?
Long, long time. Home.
Are there more like you? More apes from zoo?
Dead. All dead. Long time. Human gets sick. Ape gets smart. Then human kill ape. But not me. I run.
You learn to speak.
Listen, human. Bad ape. No touch. That's mine. I'm okay. Eat. New friends. Special day.
Komosame Kong! He lived in the jungle where he was born the king. His great strength made him lord of everything. The jungle shook beneath his mighty weight. His arms were muscled, sturdy as a tree. His chest was thick and wide as it could be. Komosame, King Kong. Komosame Kong. Komosame. Komosame Kong.
Child began to play with it. He beat his hairy